Good morning, and welcome to the City of Palm Coast virtual council meeting pursuant to the governor's, I'm putting my glasses on today, executive order suspending all Florida statutes that require a quorum to be present in person at local government meetings or require a local government body to meet at a specific public place. The city may conduct meetings of its city council without having a quorum of its members present physically or at any specific location, and utilizing communications media technology such as telephonic or video conferencing. As mayor, pursuant to the authority granted to me by city charter, I declared a public emergency on March 15, 2020, in response to COVID-19. Furthermore, pursuant to those powers in the governor's executive order, I suspended all city requirements that require a physical quorum to be present to conduct this meeting and authorize that this meeting be conducted by communications media technology under the city's state of emergency proclamation for meetings executed on April 3rd, 2020. The city manager, pursuant to the authority granted him by the city's initial state of emergency for COVID-19, has closed City Hall to the public. Therefore, no member of the public will be allowed into the community wing of City Hall during this meeting. Notice that this meeting was going to be held by communication media technology and not at a physical location was posted on the city's website at least 5 days ago. The notice provided that those members of the public needed reasonable accommodation to participate in the meeting could contact the city clerk for assistance by noon on Monday, June 8th, 2020. Access to this meeting is being provided via live stream on the city's website at www.palmcoastgov.com and by calling 386-223-1690. Today is June 9th, 2020, and it is 9 a.m. Please rise and join me in the Pledge Allegiance to the flag.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America.
Roll call, please.
Mayor Holland.
Here.
Vice Mayor Clufis.
Present.
Councilmember Branquino.
Present.
Councilmember Cuff.
Present.
Councilmember Howell is absent.
We'll now move to public participation. Any member of the public wish to make public comment, you're asked to call in to 386-223-1690. You will need to hit the *9 to raise your hand to provide your comments. Thank you, Doug. Okay, we'll close public comment. We'll now move to agenda item number 1, which is a presentation of our strategic action plan evaluation results. Did you want to introduce this item?
I did. Thank you, Honorable Mayor, City Council. Good morning. As we continue to fine-tune and work towards adoption of the strategic action plan goals, staff did take back the feedback. Thank you very much, Denise and her team, for leading that effort continually through this process. To attach the deliverables, and I think we're getting towards the budget amounts as well and how priorities are being funded. So today is really aimed at being yet another iterative session of feedback, and I believe as Denise presents, there'll be a pause at every slide to make sure we're capturing, again, the framework and deliverables of the strategic action plan goals for this coming year. So with that, Denise, thank you very much for all your work.
Thank you, Mr. Morton. Good morning, Mayor, City Council members, and staff. This is our second workshop. To date, we've conducted the one-on-one interviews with City Council members. May 12th presentation, we received that feedback and we feel that we applied it from your direction, but we do want to have this as opportunity to fine-tune, as Mr. Morton stated. Today, our goal is to receive any final feedback, request clarification, and discuss any adjustments prior to adoption, which is scheduled for next week. We're also going to talk about how staff aligned some of the direction that was given by council and really elevated last year's priority to a different state to reflect our progress today. What you see in front of you today are our focus areas as adopted by council, and one of the adjustments that we have done to better define where we're going in the future is that we did take what was previously adopted as Section G, Smart City and Fiber, and actually isolated those into a different section, giving us a heightened level of focus on moving in the right direction as Council has directed staff. So to just pause on this slide without getting into the priority, you'll see the slide structured according to the focus area. These IDs are reflecting the exhibit to the resolution. So you'll see these little cliff notes and keys at the top that says the status has been applied by staff. So items A1, A2, A4, A6, just for a sample, have been consolidated under the UNF MedNex initiative. So you'll see that structure as we go through, the presentation. And just note to City Council that the exhibit is basically an instructional guide to staff leaving today's workshop, and we will basically clean it up so it's ready for adoption next Tuesday to remove those adopted and proposed references.
I have a quick question, Denise. As far as sort of the new approach, are there going to be associated timelines and expectations on when we as a council can have a good understanding on when we, either you, Matt, or your team have identified realistic expectations of accomplishments? Some of these goals are multi-year goals. Other goals are, I think can be accomplished within 1 year. Other goals are just ongoing years. So is there a way that we can, when we're going through these, chart that to identify that? Again, to have those clear expectations. I think it's one thing when we're trying to identify the resource allocation associated with each goal, and that's certainly, under Matt's purview to identify and implement. But however, the cost associated with each goal, whether it be resource-driven or be monetarily driven or be collaboratively driven, I think there are three areas that, again, when we're diving into these a little deeper, it'd be helpful for us to understand and go, okay, now this is, council's going to be like a three-year goal we think we can accomplish within 3 years. And sometimes because of the way government is set up, goals can't be accomplished necessarily within maybe that six-month time or something like that. Does that make sense?
It does, and thank you, Mayor, for pausing on that point. We did hear that clear during the interviews. And the SAP work group is proposing a workshop in July to deliver that timeline, those budget impacts, resource impacts, as getting that next level of direction before budget adoption. So we tentatively are bringing that to council, I believe it's July 14th, to reflect on each of the focus areas and deliver what staff has put forward as a proposal for the next fiscal year and getting that feedback of your expectations for the years to come.
Okay, that's perfect. Yes.
Okay. Okay, so moving into these slides, there's 13 slides. Basically, we'll pause before we transition to the next slide, giving council the opportunity to change the narrative, define the purpose of the priority, just to do that fine-tuning so we can go into business with a clean exhibit for council consideration. So I'll read through each slide and then turn it over to council for any feedback. Continue to support UNF, MedNex, and foster relationships that continue to align program initiatives with Flagler County flagship programs, Daytona State College, and medical institutions. Develop a marketing program to recruit and host medical and technology summits and retreats to the area. Reinforce the future benefits of the UNF MedNex program that will recruit professional and higher paying jobs. Memorialize the city's position of support as a multi-year legislative priority. In the event that funding support does not move forward on the state level, revisit MedNex funding and possible reallocation to other SAP capital.
What was that? Are you saying revisit MedNex funding and possible reallocation to other sub-capital? What does that mean?
I'm sorry, Mayor. So I believe there is a word missing there that should be projects. So that was feedback received during the one-on-one interviews, and it was stated by a council member that if funding wasn't supported on the state level, I think we discussed this briefly during the previous workshop, that it would be revisited for possible consideration of looking at where that funding could be applied just by the uniqueness of where we're at in this fiscal year. So it's at this point where we can basically look at this bullet and this piece of feedback given by a council member.
On this last meeting.
We did, and I know Denise, you and I discussed this as well in relationship to making sure we have the amenity portion added and that our commitment to MedNext was not dependent on the state allocation, because it is an ongoing and remains an ongoing city priority and an ongoing state level priority, irrespective of an anticipated, you know, we anticipate it being funded by the state in this cycle, and if not, it continues to remain a priority of the stakeholders. So I thought we had taken that out, or I'd ask you to take that out to keep our commitment.
If that's a council's consensus, we'll remove that bullet before we move forward.
Yes.
Okay, and at this point, I'd just like to turn it over to council to make sure that the rest of the content is consistent with your guidance. Continuing with the Innovation District focus area, we have create an art district for the Innovation District, establish dedicated funding support through generated revenues, and foster relationships in support of a cultural arts facility while expanding programs and experiences within the district. Host an annual hackathon event that builds on the success of the 2020 Tech Beach Hackathon. Seek partnerships with local talent and complementing businesses while seeking grants to foster growth at the Tennis Center to expand on the community's rich sports history. And with that, just want to turn over to council. No feedback. Okay, we're moving into the next focus area, which is the business-friendly initiative. We have a new item, and then an item that was updated from previous workshop. B1, continue to grow the business-friendly initiative on the TRX, BRX, SCORE, and other successes to ensure enhanced customer service through technology-driven processes, parentheses, Amazon of building permits, tracking, inspection, routing, et cetera, excuse me. Then we have a new, based on feedback received last workshop, develop a communications plan that outlines the specific techniques being implemented to improve efficiencies and customer satisfaction with the goal of building public awareness.
I have a point. I think another aspect of the business friendly, and I think Jason and his team have begun the process of building greater efficiencies within this department. This department oversees. What other departments does Jason's department oversee?
Code enforcement, animal control, building and planning division, essentially.
Okay. So do we have an idea of what is realistic as far as turnaround on permit approvals? Do you set that expectation, or is that one that we as a council, frankly, should probably discuss on what's realistic far as, you know, and that, again, goes back to resources, and you have that conversation with us is, you know, that's not achievable, frankly, because we don't have the adequate enough resources for the demand that's coming in. And I know that fluctuates year after year based on the demand. And I don't know the answer to that of what our turnaround is, and I don't know where we are in comparison to other communities or best practices that have been recognized across the country. But have you given any thought to that? Because to me, I think that's more business-friendly initiatives on top of bringing together collaborative initiatives like TRX and BRX, and SCORE, you know, really highlights more of the partnership approach and more of an advocacy advisory.
So yes, we've been talking about this along several lines.
Okay.
Because I think, to your point, we have very clear direction in some areas. Let's use fire as a moment. And we've talked a lot about that with council lately, about the specific identifiable level of service that was set by the council, which is generally where you want your level of service expectations set, to respond 7 minutes or less 85% of the time. I think I got that right, Jerry. And that has informed 20 years of staffing, growth, development, a nexus for response. And so we have been talking high level of staff, saying which expectations do we need to take a look at to inform how we continue to fund, move forward, and prioritize, and more importantly, which ones are level of service that is staff driven, or which ones now should be coming back to council, to your point, for review and analysis, and say we believe these are the appropriate targets, and give a rational nexus as to why we think these are the right targets, whether it's funding, resource, external party driven. But then that gives us a framework to really start meeting a target instead of anecdotal information. We processed X billing permits, or we, you know, mowed X miles of swale. What is it we really need to be hitting, and why? And so, excellent question.
Goes back to the customer service experience, I think. So, which I know is big in your thought process walking in here. So, can we add some terminology that would be reflective of sort of just some guidance or some that you can submit to the council as far as a baseline and what you think would be realistic as an expectation of a turnaround time?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yes. I just want to add that with all fairness to the planning department and Jason, we have to understand that the building permit is not one fits all. So sometimes it's going to be a little harder for them. We've got to give them credit for what they're doing. And, you know, maybe bear with them for a little bit. Just looking at that, not every building permit is the same. Some of them are complicated, and they have to work in it properly. Okay, sometimes when you rush, especially those are the ones that are a little more harder than the other ones. The regular ones, the mid ones, then we could actually have a high level expectation when it comes to times. But certain of them, you know, I just don't think that all building permits is one fits all. But then again, I'm not saying that. Let's loosen up. Just so Jason and everybody that understands that we're not here just to push. We're here to also understand if there's a problem, they got to solve it properly. That's the only thing I had to add that. But don't change anything on that, okay?
And what I'll state is, to that point, I completely agree with you. I think it goes back to the fact of, you know, our fire department, this council has set the expectation to our residents that between 7 to 8 minutes is a response time that we feel we want to meet. Now, there are certain areas of our community that we are not able to meet those specific times. And it gives us a better decision process to say, well, then we need to add a fire station over there to meet our goals. And so I think I absolutely agree with you. You know, permits are complicated, and they're not as simple as one would think or hope. However, I do think it's fair to our staff, and I think it's fair to the residents that are doing business in City Hall, to have that expectation set, to know where we stand as a council. And then, again, it's up to sort of Matt and his team to be able to put in the appropriate resources or technology or whatever in place to be able to establish that.
Absolutely.
So.
Jason DiLorenzo and
okay, I'll take Councilmember Cuff first, and then Jason after.
Yes, thank you, Mayor. I just wanted to sort of branch off a little from what Councilmember Branchino said. Obviously, having expectations that are set for response times and so forth are fine, but I am hearing from some of the building industry, development industry, if you will, here in Palm Coast, that this is already a problem. And some of that may just be new staff and new processes. But I do think we want to, this is going to be difficult for council to set expectations in this area. And I just want to be sure that we don't adopt some fancy sounding council priorities, mission statements, buzzwords about being the Amazon of building permits and so forth, and lose sight of the fact that the folks that have to use this system day after day after day are what they're telling us. We need to keep getting input from them to help us refine what's acceptable levels of service, and not just, you know, if you're the fire department, you want to get there as fast as you can, and I understand that, and that's a useful measure of level of service. For a development permit that involves dozens or maybe even hundreds of steps to get to an approved permit or development agreement, we need to keep an eye on this and not just wrap ourselves in warm and fuzzy verbiage about what we're doing. So I think part of this process has to be continuously asking for input from the users.
I agree. Jason?
Good morning, Mayor, City Council. We have performance measures for building permits. They range from 1 day to 10 days. Most of them are manageable. 1 day would be something like a mechanical permit or a roof, something that needs to be completed. 5 days would be a home, which will take several different examinations to get through the permit process. And generally, we've made improvements and we're meeting those most of the time, and we can report that out. For commercial projects, it's 10 days, and that's a little bit more difficult because it could, you know, if you have, and you can imagine an interior build out of a commercial space compared to a brand new gas station compared to, a multifamily complex, which would also be considered commercial. They're all under the
Mr.
same.
Mr. DiLorenzo, this conversation, unfortunately, isn't helpful at this point. And I think the guidance that I'm hearing from council in general is, I know we have level of service standards, but I think the point is it's time to review those level of service standards and make sure that what was set internally or externally is meeting the needs of the development community, to Mr. Cuff's point, and then making sure we're building, continuing to build. You have done a remarkable job, but continuing to build a system that's going to drive those efficiencies towards reaching a known level of service. We know there'll be outliers and different things. So this is a great offline conversation. And I think Mayor, Council, the point's well taken that we're going to evaluate level of service, high level, in areas where it makes sense to do more legacy and resource planning. And then again, begin to align those resources that we do have currently. I know we've done a lot of hiring in the building department, and that is to continue to drive that efficiency. But again, to use those targets to start planning. I get the sense of the conversation. Let's continue to plan, not just fuddle through and have success because we're lucky or we're good, but make sure that we're designing the success level that you as a council expect and that this community demands from us. So we will continue to work on that. Thank you, Jason, for your comments.
Thank you. So if we can add, you've captured that, Denise. Okay, thank you.
I was trying to just write down what Mr. Morton just said because that really, I think, captured what I heard today. But yes, absolutely, we'll add that.
Thank you.
Moving into the next focus area, community engagement. Items C1, C2, C3 were updated, and C4, C5 are new. Start with C1, host virtual town halls and other interactive opportunities through a single source to reach our citizens. Promote Take the Challenge to be local, buy local commitment campaign. Enhance Palm Coast Connect through the integration of real-world applications. Utilize Palm Coast Connect data to drive efficiencies while integrating customer feedback. Develop a communication plan to broaden public awareness of key initiatives, including streetlights, stormwater, business-friendly initiative, innovation and art districts, and fiber. With that, I'll yield to council on any feedback.
Looks good to me.
Very good. It's good community engagement.
Moving on to service delivery and efficiency, this is one of our larger focus areas. So we'll start with D1, ensure that the public works facility is top priority facility project and commence with initial improvements based on capital improvement plan timeline. Identify public works staff to receive training and certification to supplement electrical service demands. That's underlined because that's an existing priority that would just transition into this adoption. D3, begin the examination of recycling handling options for waste collection services. D4, continue to implement water and wastewater utility improvements to harden facilities to mitigate the impacts of flooding and other hazards. That priority was updated based on council feedback.
These are all really forward-thinking and very important, so thank you.
Straightforward, very clean. D1, I love it. I love the other ones too, but D1, phenomenal.
Great. So no additional feedback? Continuing with service delivery and efficiency, provide biannual updates to City Council and the public regarding the Master Stormwater Plan to communicate how projects are being managed and prioritized. D6, continue to improve communication infrastructure and ensure redundancy as part of basic infrastructure needs. That's underlined because that's transitioning from last year's adopted priority with no changes. D7, ensure succession planning is in place with budgetary needs to ensure continuum of institutional knowledge for all departments, and that was updated as well. No feedback? Thank you. Moving on, D8, to ensure a strong workforce, evaluate service demand of the organization and determine if alternative duties can be assigned in lieu of reducing staff. D9, as part of budget process, evaluate tax rate and revenue for consideration of community economic needs. D10, seek private-public partnership opportunities for the community center to help relieve parking pressures. D11, pursue PAP tank service areas as a recognized priority risk area at the state level to ensure it is an emergency response priority.
Talk to me about D9 a little. I'm a little unclear on what that means.
Sure. So this was a piece of feedback from a council member that was reflecting on our current state with the pandemic and was concerned of needs of the community versus the budgetary process. And that's really as much as detail that I remember from that feedback provided.
So that's something we do anyway. I mean, I think I would just speak to that priority to say we're always evaluating the budget in lieu of revenues and then prioritizing by citizen needs. It's part of why we're doing this process. So I know it seems redundant, but it was just an acknowledgement of the fact that we are.
I just don't want it to be like in the middle of the year we're going to reevaluate and put projects forth when we have something that comes about. I mean, that's not how we budget in city government. It's an annual process, and it's one that is transparent and accountable to the residents, and that's why we have a public process.
Absolutely.
So I'm not sure this makes... how does this service delivery and efficiency? I don't know. I don't see it.
Does Elaine have anything to do? Anything to say about that?
Councilmember Cuff.
I don't want to make too big a deal out of this. My impression of this was this is what we do all year, every year, as part of the budget process. And I am guessing, since I'm not the author of this particular suggestion, that what it really means is if we run out of money halfway through the year, we'll take another look at items that we have budgeted for and Mr. Morton will come back to us with further efficiencies or changes or what have you. But, I mean, we always evaluate the tax rate and the revenue we can anticipate as part of setting our budget and our goals and what we believe the community, meaning the city of Palm Coast, needs at any given time.
Yeah, I agree, Bob.
I don't want to beat it to death. It just seems, on one hand, it seems redundant. On the other hand, it seems overly vague as to what exactly our priority is going to be at any given point.
I think what's important to note is, I mean, you know, this is unusual for local governments to go through this exhaustive process of dialogue and, presentations and really vetting these, because it gives clear direction to Matt to then move forward and understand exactly what, you know, he needs to be working on throughout the year. So this is a great example of why we do this, is to budget appropriately so the council knows what is appropriated every year, whether it's stormwater or capital projects or, you know, public works facility or just operational costs based on the goals and priorities that we adopt. So I don't think this one's necessary. I think it's rather confusing and doesn't really state a clear approach.
At all.
Thank you, council members, for that and revisiting why we set priorities and what's the intent behind a priority. Okay, closing out this focus area, D12, evaluate the city fleet for electrification of vehicles. D13, conduct a return on investment analysis that evaluates all city facilities for solar power retrofits and companion battery storage power. D14, conduct a cost-benefit analysis regarding implementation and ongoing maintenance of existing and proposed platforms, enterprise resource platform. And that is an addition from the last workshop, but is an existing priority that we just wanted to highlight based on the feedback we've heard since the original workshop.
Vice Mayor Klupas.
Hey, good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
I just wanted to first thank everyone on staff, including Denise and everyone who we spoke to. The priorities that we're going through right now are fantastic, and I haven't really had any feedback. I've agreed with everything that we've discussed, but I just wanted to note that the ROI on the solar evaluation is something that I think, as a city, we might be uniquely positioned to be able to recover our cost of investment and then lower our overall costs going forward. I was looking at some information online, and the ROI for some of these systems is somewhere between, you know, 10, 12 years, and those type of investments that we can make today, even though we're in, you know, a brutal economic situation with COVID, I think putting them on the table so that at least we have the option for some of these investments that are, more logical, and they're not necessarily going to provide direct feedback or improve quality of life for the city today. Or for our residents in the future, once this has been accomplished, it's basically money in the bag. So I appreciate everyone's feedback that I got back, and hopefully the council can agree that at least performing some type of feasibility study on whether or not we could go solar and what kind of time frame it would take to have a full ROI is something that we're all compatible with.
Yeah, I mean, it's similar to what the council did years ago with fiber. They made an initial capital investment that was pretty significant, and it's not only paid for itself, it's returned on the opportunity for revenue. And so I completely agree. And again, it's not only environmentally responsible, however, it really is an investment to lower the cost of operational, particularly in a lot of our public facilities that we have control over.
Correct. And I'm also not certain how it would impact our Energy Star rating. I was trying to do some research online on if, how green our City Hall is. I know that we are like on top of the top for certification-wise, but I'm unsure whether this would play into that. But hopefully staff and I can come to a conclusion on that. But that's also another potential benefit.
Councilmember Cuff.
Yes, I just it is a new item, and I was just asking for a little clarification on D14. Again, are we talking about integrating software platforms and reducing the number of different software packages we're using, or what's D14?
Yeah, that is directly in relation to a priority that this council had set forth, a goal to evaluate all of our IT contracts as well as solutions and analyze it for cost savings overall, as well as different data sets.
Thank you.
I just think that's, let's evaluate, analyze, and if it's good, let's implement it. That's what we're here for. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Council. Moving to the next focus area, streetlights and safety. Many of these items have not changed or been updated from previous year's adoption. To go through them, E1, implement continuous street lighting program for major roads. E2, evaluate residential areas for additional street lighting for safety and reduction of crime. E3, evaluate potential legislative actions to support the Sheriff's Office regarding criminal activity associated with homelessness. E4, implement the plan for emergency communication upgrades in consultation with Flagler County and other partners. E5, through emergency communication validation process, identify areas with poor or no reception. And finally, E6, monitor the progress of citywide camera master plan to include inventory and viewable coverage to determine if additional cameras are necessary. And those are all priorities underway.
That citywide camera, is that all in the parks as well, or are you, what areas are you, do we know? I know the parks were one that we asked for due to some vandalism that was occurring over at the sports complex and I think Holland Park. Would that include these, or is that a different goal?
That would be part of this,
okay.
Including that, and I think
are there other?
There's new discussions with the traffic camera system. I know we have an agreement with Flagler County Sheriff's Office, and it's making sure that all those camera security in that master plan, one, essentially is serving the needs. Instead of cameras for camera's sake, what are we looking at, why are we looking at it, and how is it driving that overall security master plan that we have?
I give great credit to Sheriff Stelly. It's real good. So if there's anything we could do to help him to fight crime and keep her safe, once again, as a no-brainer.
Okay, we have a new E7, conduct reoccurring meetings with FPNL to discuss streetlights, pet tank service areas, and service disruption and other priority areas. Any feedback on this particular priority before we move forward?
Just that that needs to absolutely 100% happen regularly. I think the more we can engage with them, I have found historically, once they understand Palm Coast's specific needs, they have offered to help on different occasions. I think we just need to solidify that, codify the relationship, and figure out ways where, you know, we can get a little bit more of concrete answers when we are meeting a timeline.
Can I ask a question? I'm sorry to interrupt. Maybe out of order, but Denise, you can inform me. And then we had also, similar to this or companion to this, had regular meetings with FDOT. Is that later in the, did I miss that? Is that another slide?
I believe that was incorporated in the in two priorities. One was the Trailhead grant application for the tennis center as an underlying initiative. And then also the Old Kings Road phase 2 and 3, making sure that those were in DOT plan, but it's not called out specifically, but we can more than easily add that.
That's what I brought up. I'm sorry. I had heard council the priority, and I may have been remiss to communicate that. I know you've run the process, but this establishment of those regular meetings with our key stakeholders, including FPL, FDOT, DEO, and folks, to make sure that we continually communicate our needs, both financially and policy-driven, to position us towards our goals and our outcomes.
I know we meet a lot with the Water Management District, but is that just something we've done historically?
To speak on like environmental resource permitting, it's usually done on a project per project basis. I know utility has a great relationship with the water management district and has constant communication with them on those initiatives as well. But if you, as a council, like to add that, absolutely.
What I had heard is us being strategic and identifying those partnerships that maybe we don't have regularly. Like, I give another good example was Fine. I know when we approached Fine for an opportunity. I said, well, we haven't really talked to the city in a year or longer. So I had heard a priority that said, evaluate those strategic partnerships and our stakeholder partnerships and make sure we are regularly being proactive in communicating with all those agencies, whether it's FIND, whether it's DEO, you know, all those agencies that are essential to us to continue to do the business of the city.
Vice Mayor Klukas.
Yep, thank you. I was just hopeful that we could also keep in sight when FPL hardens their infrastructure, for example, replacing the wooden electrical poles with the big concrete ones. We had spoken to our the representative who had recently retired, his name eludes me, but if we could just, for context, just be made aware when those type of projects are moving forward. I'm sure that they have to go through some type of permitting process. I understand that the cost to underground electrical is incredibly expensive. It's almost like $1 million a mile, but the more quickly that we can communicate what's going on with the grid to our residents, I think they'll just feel more comfortable when they see those type of decisions being made, just so that they're made aware. But also, if the opportunity presents itself to underground infrastructure in somewhere that the council feels viable, I think just bringing those things up, even if they're consistently, let them put up the hardened infrastructure and we don't underground anything, it'd still be nice to have those brought before us, just so we're made aware.
Thank you for that input. I agree.
Moving on to street maintenance. F1 continue to ensure funding of streets maintenance program for striping and resurfacing by providing a projection of road maintenance currently budgeted versus needs for future years. F2, as part of street resurfacing and maintenance program, investigate and where feasible apply the following. Intersection safety improvements shall be conducted to address turn radius conflicts, enhancements to support the use of autonomous vehicles, traffic calming alternatives, striping, road bumps, etc. So that's a consolidated priority that's a hybrid between the guidance provided by council and also existing adopted priorities, just to align our efforts.
So I think also what we probably need to add at one point is as more vehicles are either electric or the hybrid, and we see a reduction in our fuel tax. I know the state is evaluating this right now of different funding sources to apply for ongoing road infrastructure projects and maintenance. And I'd rather get ahead of it and look at it and just understand it a little bit more as, we move forward, because, that's going to come up. And if we're, 10 years out as a city and we have no plan, we're only relying on fuel tax, and we've seen it reduced, yet we still have to maintain these roads, we still have to, expand on our infrastructure, how is that ultimately going to be funded, I think is an important conversation to have.
Yes.
And with that point, Mayor, any recommendations of amending this priority or just moving forward in the direction you just set forth?
So, Council, thoughts of just, again, adding some language of just alternative ways of funding our road maintenance project would probably be something I think we need to, at least if it's setting funding aside for future years, I really applaud the former councils of the city of Palm Coast who were very thoughtful in future decisions, like our emergency management fund. Again, that's unheard of. We've sustained 3 hurricanes in a matter of 3 years, and it didn't bankrupt the city. In fact, it didn't even deplete our reserves. It took that emergency management fund, and we're able to remain operational throughout this whole time period, which is due to the fact of the decisions that former councils made that adopted a funding strategy that went along with that. So, council, any objections to sort of at least applying that? I don't know, Matt, how you would look at that or just maybe view that?
Thank you for the question. Yeah, I think trying to assign some target to it rather than just being anecdotal. So, you know, pursuing a strategy or a plan or investigating, you know, I mean, I think you hit it, but I want to make sure we understand the priority and actually have a deliverable instead of it just being conversational. So, I mean, I think we can develop a framework if we get the developing alternatives to traditional street funding. You know, when we understand it's in lieu of what we know is a long-term reduction in per gallon tax at this point.
And
that's called thinking ahead.
Yeah.
And that's what people put us here for. And if we could discuss it, talk about it right now, if we're bright enough to see what the future is going to bring, we can only help the people coming after us. And by doing that, we're helping the city of Palm Coast.
I know, like, when the city received the half-cent sales tax from a 20-year agreement, I think, with the county, maybe it wasn't 20-year, it was Helena may know or someone that was here previous, they adopted 50 road miles per year utilized based on the sales tax revenue collected, and it was a direct fund, and so the residents knew what to expect. The manager knew sort of that was the fund applied to it. The teams knew. And then the council set that goal of 50 road miles per year. Now we've been told by Carl and his team that that's, you know, we're good in that position now. However, roads are going to continue to deteriorate. And I know it's already underfunded as a fund to begin with, and I just don't want to get further behind.
That's I also call it transparency.
Yeah.
That's what we're doing right now, showing what we're going to do in the future, at least talk about it, and prevent from something going crazy and happening in the future.
Vice Mayor Klufas?
Yeah, thank you, Mayor. I would also just like to note this council has taken aggressive measures to try to be on the forefront of newer technologies to assess our road conditions. And I think I won't speak for the whole council, but I would like to see as many innovative ideas, such as like running those LIDAR scanners right behind the assessment vehicles and across our different trails and such, to make sure that we're properly assessing the size of cracks and then making the right decisions on whether remilling and paving is necessary or whether or not we can get away with some of the less expensive short-term fixes that will extend like the overall life of the road. I think in the next, you know, year or 5 years, it's important that we just keep an eye on any new technologies that could possibly give us that, you know, edge to be able to close the gap on the disparity between what we need to fund our roads to keep them all at the A rating versus our current trajectory. So I just want to applaud the council for being forward-thinking and entertaining those ideas, but also if we can just make a note to keep our mind open, because this is an area where we spend a lot of money, and I think there's going to be some innovative solutions in the future to extend road life, but I just want to make sure that we keep that in mind. Thank you.
Thank you. So does that help, Denise?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. All right. Matt, does that help?
Absolutely, yes,
okay.
Thank you.
And the final priority on this slide, ensure that phase 2 and 3 of Old Kings Road are included in FDOT project plan.
And we would like to get some confirmation on when, hopefully that, you know, when you guys meet, of a response from FDOT on the cycle of that. If it's in the 1 5-year and then the 10-year, and again, anything we can do to advance it, we always want to be on top of that. This is a very congested roadway in our city, and it's going to continue to be as growth occurs in that part of our city. So I just want to make sure that funding is secured, and It's not going to be an interruption when we got all the easements. We've done a tremendous amount of work up front. That will give us added value when we have these conversations with District 5.
Moving into Smart City, as noted at the beginning of the presentation, we did sever Smart City and fiber into two different sections. So G1, as technology advances, staff to continue the investigation of adaptive traffic control solutions and enhancements. That's an existing priority, moving forward with an update. And just pause for any council feedback. Okay. Moving forward to our last focus area, fiber. These are existing priorities, so they're just moving forward into a different section. H1, evaluate fiber initiative with the University of Florida Whitney Lab facilities to determine mutually beneficial opportunities. H2, develop a master plan that depicts the existing and future expansion of the fiber infrastructure. H3, based on the fiber master plan, determine the feasibility requiring existing and proposed development to incorporate fiber infrastructure. Those are all underway and proposed to move forward as part of the adoption exhibit. And any feedback from council? Okay. So that concludes.
Vice Mayor Klufas?
Sorry, I was slow on the raise hand button. I was just hopeful that we could kind of put a fire underneath us to work together with Donald and Bill to see whether or not the validity for us becoming an ISP can be accelerated, actually get some type of like concrete answer on, even though that we have been allocated an ISP, I don't want to call it justification, but classification that we are an ISP, whether or not we're allowed to outwardly sell bandwidth to retail users. If we can put a focus on accelerating the flushing out of all those details and whether or not it's like a viable path forward to see whether or not we have to go through all the hoops that a brand new municipality would have to go through, I think in addition to the fiber master plan, really seeing whether the city can just kind of pull our hair back and become, you know, fast paced to becoming ISP and selling to retail users, because I think that's where we have a lot of opportunity. And I know that Donald's excited about that. And of course, there's legal issues. And if we can just get them out in the open and in front of council, maybe we can make a decision on how hard and aggressive we try to push back, or it's a smooth process for us becoming to be able to be a retailer of our own bandwidth. So I just want to put that out there. Sorry, I was slow on the raise hand.
Okay. Again, that goes through Matt. So Matt, you have to drive that.
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely. Yeah, we understand. We are. I would. You know. Again, since we're here in the spirit of transparency, I feel like we'll be definitely behind on this priority, and I don't think we're aligning it with the council vision. And I know this continues to be important. Council stressed its importance of moving this forward. So message received, and we'll be bringing some information forward hopefully soon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And with that final slide, that concludes our inventory of the proposed drafted priorities and the feedback we received. Of course, will be applied to the exhibit, and hopefully we'll hit the mark. And with that, I would like to open up to any final questions for staff or additional direction moving forward.
Council, any questions or comments at this time?
Not at this point, not on me.
Just a great job, Denise. Honestly, this is how we are able to keep taxes as low as we are, is by planning. And this is a great tradition in the city of Palm Coast that started with you, and I'm just very grateful how it's transformed and how we've gotten here today. It's very helpful for me, so I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Mayor, for those kind words, and we couldn't do it without council, so thank you for that direction, and we will make these changes and get that in front of you for business and propose adoption.
Thank you.
Thank you, Denise.
Okay. We will now move to agenda item number 2, which is an ordinance amending Chapter 29 impact fees, fire and rescue system impact fee. Matt, are you going to introduce this
item? Absolutely, yes. Okay. Thank you, Honorable Mayor and Council. I won't spend a lot of time introducing just because we do have Chief Forte. I think we have Deputy Chief Brad Clark, and then we have our at least one consultant from RAFTELUS. I believe we might have both consultants on this morning. But essentially, in continuing with council priority, this is an analysis to continue to make sure that, in essence, the simplest statement I can make is that growth continues to pay for growth, and that we're assessing those costs rationally and proportional to the what they call the nexus of impact. And so this is an updated impact fee ordinance that allows us to continue to meet that objective service standard set by council years ago. And with that, I would turn over to the fire chief to lead us off.
Thank you, Mr. Morton. Good morning, Mayor and Council. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Too well.
Okay. Thank you, sir. Today, we will be hearing from Sean Ocasio and Henry Thomas from RAFTELUS, who will be presenting about the fire impact fee study. But before we present to the group, I would like to recap quickly what our department has done individually with each of the council members over the last 2 weeks, and it's been a busy couple of weeks. First, we disseminated the 10-year plan electronically so that you can have an idea of where the department was. We talked about that this was a rigid document, and it outlines the nearly 50 years our fire department's been in existence, as well as what our current status is of the operation. We reviewed the department's mission statement of deliver the best service to our community every time, which simplifies what our goal is, and every time we go to a call, we do the best that we can every time. We use team concepts to build employee empowerment and inclusion in future planning. We looked at the 9 department initiatives, which are flexible and fluid for future operations. Every plan needs the ability to adjust the changing times, and we feel that these 60-plus initiatives will sustain our planning process well into the 2040 year, and doesn't matter who the administrator is, it could be adjusted at any point. Our team worked last week with each of you to represent the goals of the fire department, which would be goal 1 for deployment. The initiative is 1A, conduct a fire station location study using geographic information systems, incident data, and projected growth. Together, we use population growth, call density, response times for over 20 years to compile our data. We use 2 types of research to conduct the study. One is forecasting models using current systems to identify what the response times would be for a 6-minute lag from the fire station to the call. And we also use current response data to prove the forecasting models for accuracy. We also identified gaps in current services in areas that are not meeting the City Council goals of responding to calls 7 minutes or less 85% of the time. This is a City Council goal that has been in existence since the first City Board in 2002. We identified gaps in current coverage, and they were identified as South Seminole Woods, Whiteview Parkway off of US 1. That's in the areas under current operation. We provided you with a recommendation for fire station typing and coverage projections for those areas of growing population. We made the determination between a full-size fire station and a smaller residential type fire home, which would house people during peak time hours. We provided a need analysis for the areas of future development to include Colbert Lane, Palm Coast Park, and further westward expansion. By forecasting Colbert Lane as a possible joint fire station with Flagler Beach, the fire protection would be an inclusion for a county ambulance as well for medical coverage. Those projections were looking 7 to 10 years or more out. We also found that Palm Coast Park along US 1 does not support immediate construction for staffing of a fire station. Station 23 in Indian Trails has a built-in capacity to cover for the next 10 years. We will, however, monitor this location and make recommendation when the station falls above that capacity and we see response times in the north end of the city decline in effectiveness. On a direct note, I have to commend both Sean and Henry for their guidance in coming up with the fire impact fee and working with our city staff, including our command staff and many of the people in the building department and the engineering department to help give us an idea of what we have to do. They helped us find the information that we needed to identify our gaps and where we need to improve. And they kind of pushed us a little longer, a little harder than we thought we'd have to go, but we have a firm understanding of where we need to be. If the mayor and the council is good, we can turn it over to them unless they have any questions.
Council, any questions for our chief at this time?
Well, at the end, I'll...
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, at this time, we'll turn it over to Sean Ocasio and Henry Thomas.
Good morning, Mayor and council members. This is Henry Thomas. I'm with Reftalis, as was mentioned earlier, and I'm vice president and was the project director for this assignment. As you know, we have conducted other impact fee assignments for the city, as well as we assist you with water and wastewater financing and rates. Sean is gonna also present with me today. Sean was the lead in this and primary contact with the city and prepared the analyses that resulted in our proposed impact fees. So Sean's gonna start the presentation for me right now. Sean, I don't see it. Okay, it's coming up. Okay, so to start with, as you know, the purpose of this study was to provide a basis for proposed impact fees for fire and rescue services. And again, these are fees that are paid by new development based on increased demands on the services that the city provides. The fees will be used to pay for growth-related fire and rescue facilities and equipment, including fire stations, firefighting apparatus, fire trucks that will be required to meet the growth in your community. Currently, the city charges $223.38 per residential dwelling unit and 28.32 cents per non-residential development per square foot. Again, when we conduct these impact fee studies, we have to be mindful of the legal considerations. The basis for impact fees and the related criteria have been developed under Florida statutes and many years of Florida case law. The Florida Impact Fee Act history under Section 163 of the Florida statutes was began in June 14, 2006. It's been amended several times in recent years, and we'll discuss here what some of the criteria are included in the Act. And again, the Act does not necessarily overlap with the case law that has determined what a valid impact fee is. So the Impact Fee Act requires that the calculation of impact fees be based on the most recent and localized data. And we've certainly taken that into account in developing the fees that we'll propose this morning to you. It also provides that you need to have accounting and reporting of the impact fee revenues and expenditures and separate funds. The city is in compliance with that requirement. It limits administrative charges that can be included in the fees. And this is an important one, it requires 90 days notice before imposing a new or increased fee. Now, once you have the public hearing and adopt it, you have to give the development community a grace period of 90 days before you can actually begin collecting the fee. That's what that's referring to. So while we have notice for public hearings, we also have this 90-day period between adoption and implementation. It also requires an annual affidavit to be signed by the city's director of finance, acknowledging compliance. It is important to note that the law required that the government has the per burden of proof in any challenge. In the past, the burden of proof was really on the development community that may challenge the fees, and the impact fee law indicates that the burden of proof is on local governments. That's why many local governments now are updating their impact fees and doing studies similar to this one that we prepared for the city of Palm Coast. And then one of the most recent changes in the Act in 2019 was that the fee cannot be charged before the issuance of a building permit. So you can charge it concurrently with that, but not prior to the issuance of the building permit. Some of the criteria that has come from case law, reference was made earlier to the impact of new development. There needs to be there's a dual rational nexus test that's required, and it's based on the cost of capacity, of service capacity to serve new growth. And the dual part says that then, while the fees must be based upon the capital cost requirements anticipated for providing service to new development, they then must be spent on those same types of capital costs at once those fees are collected and put into use. So again, it's important to note that these fees charged to new development are for the capital investments necessary to provide capacity to serve new growth and are not to be used for operating cost deficiencies, hiring new staff. It's strictly those costs that are capital in nature. The case law requires that you develop a reasonable level of service standards that meets the needs of the city. In this case, you have a level of service standard that is with regard to response time. And as the chief indicated in looking at future needs for fire services, they utilize that response time to develop the proposed infrastructure that will be needed to fight the fires, locations of fire stations and such, which we have used as the basis for the capital costs to be recovered. All of that was based upon meeting that response time standard that the city has adopted. And then finally, if there's capital deficiencies, you cannot use those funds to meet that. Growth can't be expected to pay for a system that's currently deficient, but should only pay for the capacity needed to serve new growth. And again, we can't use it to pay operating costs. So at this point, I'm going to turn it over to Sean, and he's going to go through the details to arrive at the proposed fees with you over the next few minutes.
Thank you, Henry. Going forward, I'll get into the methodology used and the actual analysis that took place in order to develop the fees. So with respect to the fee calculation methodology that was used, the first thing we wanted to do is make sure that we capture and identify all of the existing investment in fire rescue department, as well as the future projects that will be to serve growth in the future. So we wanted to make sure that we had the asset side of existing and then the forward-looking side. So there's two parts to the fee that we're trying to capture. We then go through and we want to make sure that we allocate the costs recovered. So what we use there, and we'll discuss it a little further on in a couple of slides, is how we split the costs then between the residential fee and the non-residential customer classes. And then once we have those costs allocated, we then take those costs and calculate the fee per unit on a dwelling unit basis for residential and on a per square footage basis for non-residential properties. So one of the first steps in our analysis is then developing a forecast of population and dwelling units for the city. And what we do is we took information from the U.S. Census Bureau. We also looked from the Bureau of Economic and Business Research from the University of Florida, as well as the Florida Housing Data Clearinghouse, which are two other sources that we use just to get a feel for growth throughout the state of Florida. And then we also received information from the city's planning department with respect to the population growth that's coming forward, as well as the total dwelling units through build out of the city. And one thing to note is these population and unit projections are consistent with the population and unit projections that were used in the Parks and Recreation fee study that was presented a little while back. So what we have is the estimated population, this was as of 2019, of about 88,000 residents with about 38,349 total dwelling units. So that's on average about 2.3 persons per household. And then based on the forecast of units going forward, it's estimated that at build out, the population will be approximately 186,000 with total dwelling units of about 80,987. And then using this forecast of population and units, we then also will develop our projection of commercial square footage going forward. And what we do is we take the existing total developed non-residential square footage of the city, which is about 7.2 million square feet, and we related it to the existing dwelling units, which was about 39,000 for 2020. And then using that relationship, projecting it forward based on the build-out projection, that comes to about 14,896,000 square feet of non-residential commercial square footage. So those will be the units that we divide by in order to develop the fee on a per unit basis. One of the other things that we looked at is the existing level of service. The current target is a response of 7 minutes or less, 85% of the time. We also looked at the staffing levels for the fire rescue department. Currently, they're staffed about 109 personnel, of which 77 are full-time personnel, and that includes 20 fire suppression volunteers. There are also 30 non-fire suppression volunteers, as well as two administrative positions within the department. And with respect to the full-time personnel, this comes to about 0.85 personnel per 1,000 residents. So then going back to what I mentioned a moment ago, one of the tasks is to look at the existing investment, capital investment for the department. And so what we did was we got the fixed asset registry from the city's finance department, as well as other asset information from the fire group. And there are five stations currently in service for the city. That's stations 21 through 25. And that comes to an existing investment of about $11.8 million. Then with fire trucks and other support vehicles, so pumpers, tower trucks, aerials, and other vehicles, the city currently has invested about $5.1 million in those assets. And then other supporting equipment, personal protective equipment, and other gear, that's about $1.3 million. So total existing investment in the fire department is about $18.2 million. But then we also want to make sure that we don't count on any capital that's already been funded from outside sources, such as grants and contributions. So there was about $1.5 million of the $18.2 that was funded through these grants and contributions. So we net those out because we can't capture those in the fee calculation, which gives us a net investment in existing capital of approximately $16.7 million. Then on the forward-looking side, based on our discussions with the working group and the capital information provided, the major items in the capital plan going forward through build-out are three additional full-size fire stations, and that's including facilities and vehicles that would be about $14.9 million, and these would be at Seminole Woods, Colbert Lane, State Road 100 Station, Palm Coast West, and each of these would be equipped with a Class A pumper, a brush attack, and utility vehicles. In addition to these three full-sized facilities, there's also two mini stations that are also in the plan, and those come to a total of about $2.5 million of projected investment. That would be Station 251 at Whiteview and Station 252 at Belterre Boulevard. And each of these stations would be equipped with a mini attack fire engine. Other forward-looking capital investment needs would be for personnel and equipment items of about $1 million, as well as a future training facility for the department at about $3.5 million. So with respect to forward-looking capital investment to take the department through build-out, it's just under $22 million, about $21.9 million. So then, as mentioned previously, one of the things we need to do is then allocate these costs, these existing and future investments that we just talked about a moment ago. And what we utilized is the actual demands of fire calls for the city. And so it comes to about just under 77% of all calls are residential related, and 23% are non-residential related. And these ratios were developed based on looking at the call data for the years of 2017 through 2019, and this is the average of those. So, and that's generally in line with what we see in most municipalities, mostly residential demand. So then in terms of the actual calculation of the fee itself, we have the existing investment in the department, which is the $18 million mentioned previously, and then the planned future investment, which is the $21.9 million, for a total investment of approximately $40,082,000. Then subtracting off any grants and contributions, that would be the $1.46 million number there, to a total net investment in the Fire Rescue Service Department of about $38.6 million. This would be historical and forward-looking through build-out. Then allocating, bifurcating this amount between residential and non-residential classes by the demand or the call data that we had, that's where we get the $29.7 million and the $8.8 million shown. Then based on our population and unit forecast, so we're taking all of these costs through build-out, and then we're dividing it based on the build-out units for residential, which would be the 80,987, and the non-residential, the 14,896,000. So when we do that out, we get a proposed residential fee on a per dwelling unit basis of $367 per unit, and for the non-residential class, a fee of 59 cents per non-residential square footage of development.
What is considered non-residential?
So non-residential would be stores, retail, restaurants, any sort of institutional classes, assisted living facilities, things of that nature.
That was interesting. So assisted living facilities are considered non-residential?
Yes, typically that's how they're categorized. There are some communities in Florida that treat them as residential, typically they're considered non-residential in most communities.
We have correct me if I'm wrong, I guess I would ask the chief, assisted living facilities are usually the demand for calls is pretty high, correct?
That's correct, Mayor, but we have to make a differentiation between what would be considered a standard ALF, which would be a Grand Oaks or something of a large capacity, which is considered a commercial operation for the healthcare of someone, as opposed to we have an unusually large population of residential homes that have been converted to small units of less than five people in a group. So when you start looking at the commercial aspect of ALFs, we certainly have our fair share of the smaller ALF units, but we also have a large grouping of larger facilities, which falls under the commercial connotation.
Why do some communities establish it as residential? What's the thought process behind that? I would ask the consultant, I guess, since he brought it up.
Yes, ma'am. Again, that's probably in the minority, and so the underlying basis for the fees for fire is typically that the property that's being protected by fire services. So where you really see these impact fees being applied to assisted living on a residential basis is usually in recreation impact fees, where it's considered population driven as opposed to property driven. So again, I couldn't tell you more than a small handful of communities, maybe three or four that I'm aware of, that might consider fire to be ALS facilities to be residential in nature. And it's largely because, as the chief said, in many cases they have operate with kitchens and dining facilities, and it's not laundry facilities and not your typical residence. So I can't really candid about this, we've never recommended these facilities to be residential. So I can't tell you what the rationale is in that small handful that do treat them as residences.
Okay, it's interesting. I would think that they require a tremendous amount of services. I just didn't know. And they are residential, people live there. So I don't know, interesting, okay.
Thank you. And moving ahead, then based on the fee calculations we spoke of a moment ago, they compared to the current fees that were mentioned at the beginning of the presentation, it's a change of about $143 per residential dwelling unit. So it's about a 64.3% increase in the fee. And for non-residential on a per square footage basis, it's going from the 28.32 cents to 59 cents. So that's an increase of about 108% on the per square foot fee. So with respect to how the city compares to other Florida departments, as you can see on the left end of the chart, the existing rate of $223.38, it's on the very low end of the comparison, with the average for the surveyed departments being about $396.43, and the proposed fee of $367 for the residential fee still comes underneath that average, puts you about the middle of the pack there. So, you know, everything's still generally in line.
Where's St. John's County?
I'm sorry?
St. John's County. I mean, St. John's County has the majority of population. They have a tremendous amount of growth. Where do they fall in? City of St. Augustine has 14,000 residents. I'm just curious.
For the county, I don't believe I have that on hand, but I can look into that.
I think that'd be helpful.
Sure. Yeah. I'll make a note. We do have St. Augustine there at over the $600 mark. And again, one of the things we also want to mention when we look at these comparisons is why the fees can differ between the various municipalities shown. And that can have to do with the level of capital investment in the fire and rescue facilities. You know, if there's, in some places they have combined like headquarters for police and fire, and if those are new facilities, they can be higher cost. It can be a function of any the amount of grant funding and contributed assets to the departments. If you have a municipality that has a high amount of grant contributions, then the cost being recognized within the fee calculation would be lower. Another thing can be differing levels of service. The higher level of service may require a larger investment, as well as the nature of the level of service and the location of the municipality. If they're, let's say, a coastal environment like y'all and have a lot of high-rise hotels, there might be different equipment required to service them. Whereas if you're in an area that has less upwards development, you may not need as many, large aerial or tower trucks. So it can vary based on the needs, the unique needs of each community. And then the other item is that it can also be a function of the percentage of the fee implementation that the governing body decides upon. So, you know, a fee may be calculated at a certain amount, but then the governing body can then elect to implement a fraction of those fees. And as long as all classes within the city are treated equally, that can be an item. So I've worked with clients where a fee of, let's say $700 was calculated, but the governing body chose to implement only 80% of that fee. And as long as you do that for both the residential and the non-residential classes equally, then that's an acceptable practice. And so for the conclusions, I'm gonna hand it back off to Henry.
So again, impact fees are intended to fund the capital and infrastructure demands that new development places on your city. To the extent we maintain these fees at appropriate levels, it ensures that growth pays for the costs, the capital costs required to provide capacity to serve that growth. We believe these proposed fees fulfill the requirements of the Florida Impact Fee Act. With respect to our recommendations, we recommend that you adopt the proposed fire and rescue impact fees. In addition, the capital cost considerations that went into this study were based upon current levels of cost as if we were building those facilities today, so that we're also recommending that annually you maintain these fees over time with small adjustments based on the construction cost index as published by the Engineering News Record. Again, we've counted for the major facilities that will be required to build out, and obviously, as those are built in the future, there will be some cost inflation and construction costs, and that's what this is attempting to reflect. We believe that you should review your fees periodically to keep in line with either changes in development patterns, proposed infrastructure and capacity related investments, you know, any major changes in that occur would be a good time to do it. Otherwise, you know, periodically, and there's no real rule of thumb on that. But we're seeing, you know, at least every 3 to 5 years, or again, when there's some major change in the plan. It is based upon, that way it's based upon recent localized data. It does reflect development trends, level of service requirements that may change, and changing capital needs. And finally, the last two recommendations are to continue to maintain your separate accounting, and that if adopted, we would recommend that you implement this fee change 90 days from the date of, a minimum of 90 days from the date of adoption, so that you'll be in compliance with the statute. So the final part of the presentation is to suggest what the next steps are. But before we do that, why don't you ask any questions that you may have?
Council, any questions or comments at this time?
I just have a comment, and the comment is 7 or less minutes, 85% of the time that we ask out of the fire department. If we are going to ask them to do that, we can't forget that we got to give them the human resources and also the material resources they need to do that. Our city is growing. There are certain needs that they come with it. So, when looking at this impact fees, you're talking about an increase of $143. If you divide that, anybody who buys a house, if the builder passes on to anybody who buys a house, you're looking at a 30-year mortgage. You're talking about cents. So insignificant, with all due respect, because some people cannot afford it. I have respect that. You're talking about cents a month. So I think it's sometimes a little sacrifice that we have to make in order for us to be safe. Don't forget, there's a chart out there that shows that if we could respond in 7 minutes or less, or the lower the response time, the less insurance you're going to pay, because insurance companies look at that. So therefore, this increase, in my opinion, until I'm told otherwise, it's actually a saving for us. Thank you.
Vice Mayor Clufus.
Thank you. I was just going to bring up the fact that we don't necessarily know the economic impact of the COVID-19 virus on our economy right now, or how this is going to impact housing construction within like the next 3 to 6 months. I'm just curious as to if we do see a shift in economic situations for the city, do we reevaluate at that point? Because I guess my question comes down to, like, what is the threshold for defining the event when we have to reassess? And I only ask because I feel as if we may not, as a whole, not just Palm Coast, we may not be feeling the shorter term to medium term impacts of the COVID-19 virus on our economy. And if that does have a shift in the building paradigm or just housing in general, do we reevaluate at that time? Or how do you envision the time frame being impacted and possibly like duplicated to reassess? And I suppose that question is for our consultant.
But just to take a first shot at this is, we ran into this very similar circumstance back in 2009 when we had the economic downturn. and our rates for commercial or non-residential constructions were up at the high 50 cent per square foot rate. And at the time we made the decision that to promote the growth of the community and to allow builders to put permits in and continue the growth, we would lower the rate to what it is today, I believe 23 cents per square foot. We didn't touch the residential. That was an opportunity that we gave to the community to show that we're gonna lower the rates so that we understand the economic circumstances. Those circumstances were different then because of the real estate market was the economic problem. And right now we don't see that as it being the problem. As a matter of fact, you put a house on the market, you'll be lucky it's on there for a month.
Yeah.
What we are seeing is the real estate market is still holding strong. And then the moment that we start to see that we have those things and we could bring this information before council, certainly the directors that are responsible for permitting and engineering will get together with buyer and discuss this. But it does give us the option. If we raise the rates, so to speak, we know that we're capturing today's building and construction rates, but we always have the ability to fall back to what our current situation is.
Yeah, and I suppose the onus is being put on trying to remain agile enough so that if the assessments we're making today aren't comparable, or aren't sufficient to be able to fulfill the needs that we have for these impact fees, to be able to supplement, you know, ensuring that, like Eddie said, Councilmember Aquino said, you know, the rules are basically get to me as soon as possible so that I don't go into cardiac arrest and my percentage chance of surviving is very low. Like, we need to provide this level of service to our community. But I just want to ensure that we're agile and fluid enough. I just feel like the housing market inevitably is going to be impacted by this. We have, you know, 30 million people without jobs, and I'm curious, like, I know that housing prices right now are remaining constant, but just the fact that we don't have to wait 3 to 5 years to be able to reassess if something were to happen, so that we can remain competitive in the geopolitical landscape of neighboring counties and such. And, you know, I mean, back in 2009, you made a great point. If we look at what we did and then what surrounding counties did, there were a bunch of different strategies to try to mitigate that risk. And I just want to make sure that we remain fluid and in a dynamic state where we're constantly able to readjust these things, because I honestly feel like, and I hope I'm wrong, that there could be that type of event in our somewhat near future, like in the remainder of this year, perhaps.
Just to also follow up is, we also look at the possibility of looking at the plan holistically for the next 25 years. And if, for example, we don't need Station 252 in the south end of Belterra because we're able to secure Citation Boulevard to go from Seminole to Belterra, we physically do not have to put a structure there because the response time from Station 26 in Seminole Woods would get the south end of Belterra. Again, that's in a savings to the community that we can actually look at this as a readjustment and possibly consider that 8 years down the road when we get to that point. So being fluid and flexible when looking at the locations of where we know we're going to be building is paramount when you're doing a project like this.
Yeah, I have the utmost confidence. So thank you very much for your response. And I certainly believe with all the data that you guys have, you're very agile and dynamic and able to fulfill the needs of the city. So thank you very much for everything you guys have done.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
I have a question about how the impact fees themselves for fire can be utilized. You know, I have a clear understanding when we did parks, utilities are pretty straightforward. So are we able to utilize that? You're talking about new growth. Can that be applied to current fire stations with new equipment placed in those stations?
Okay, so the application of the our use of the fees cannot be used to replace an existing firefighting vehicle or apparatus. But if you expand your fleet, it can be used for that. So what we're really required to do is use these fees to pay for new fire stations, expansion of the fleet, and the personnel equipment that gets capitalized. There's some significant personnel equipment as the staff grows. So if we're talking about replacing a fire truck, no, but if we're adding a fire truck to an existing station? Yes. And one of the reasons we blended both existing and future assets together to calculate the fee is that as the fire department reconfigures the response time map and what stations are required, oftentimes the area that an existing station serves may overlap or change due to the building of the new fire station. So we look at it as a holistic capital investment in firefighting. And again, as long as it's expansion, it doesn't have to be at a new fire station, but be expansion of the firefighting equipment.
Yeah, I just say that because, you know, we do have pockets of new growth. You know, you mentioned Neoga Lakes or Old Brook Township, or we have Palm Coast Park that's brand new. You know, those are land, mass amounts of land that will be developed. However, ITT master planned this community, and we have several thousand developable lots within, you know, existing neighborhoods, and I'm sure that's going to add to the call volume and spread our resources a little thinner when it comes to those neighborhoods, as you know, as far as when they're on calls and they're prioritizing those calls. If another call is called out from a different station and it takes more time to get there, I wonder if anyone is considering the fact of maybe maximizing our current infrastructure and utilizing those dollars as a strategy to actually maximize the response time in different neighborhoods. Does that make sense?
Yes, Mayor. Just to touch on that, there's two thoughts on that. First is we can control the calls that are going out for the fire stations through emergency medical dispatching. We can actually send the appropriate vehicle to the appropriate call with the appropriate response, and thereby leaving either the engine or the ambulance back at the fire station to handle the secondary calls that come into those zones. That's an ideal situation that Deputy Chief Clark has been working with County Deputy Chief Joe King on trying to institute, and we can see something possibly come to fruition with that this year. The second aspect is by looking at this regionally and what we have in the city, we know Station 21 by Coles and Station 25, the main station, run 55% of our calls. And we know that there's a gap on Whiteview. And by putting a smaller station on Whiteview that accommodates the peak hours, we know we're going to draw some of the calls away from those two zones when that station goes into service. That doesn't take away the need for the other two stations. It just reduces their capacity to handle more calls in that area. So by looking at it, we're actually trying to level out the calls throughout the city and all the fire stations and addressing those needs as they come up. When that station goes in, it'll take about 6 months to see what the benefit would be after Whiteview goes in, and we can see how the capacity is built in. Station 24 and Station 23 have significant capacity, and we know that we've got a lot of growth coming in the north end of Matanzas and along US 1. I'm confident that station can handle a lot of those calls. And again, we'll take a look at that when we get to the point of seeing the response times change, either for a positive or a negative, that will make that determination.
Okay, thank you. That answers that. Okay, we can move forward.
So from this point on, I've worked with Carl Cody, and he's come up with a schedule of what the timeline would be. So today you're hearing the presentation on the station response study and the impact fee. On June 10th, we were looking at meeting with the Home Builders Association with Jason DiLorenzo, setting that meeting up. And Chief Clark and Chief Berryhill and I will be meeting with them to review the plan. June 16th, we're looking at the first reading of the ordinance at a business meeting. June 17th, advertisement for the newspaper for posting a minimum of 5 days. June 7th is the second reading. And if you choose to adopt, then we would have the 90-day waiting period would take effect October 5th. That's all we have for you, Mayor.
Council, any further questions or comments on this agenda item? Seeing none, I appreciate both the consultant's presentation as well as our fire chief. A very comprehensive, very thoughtful, well thought out, and well planned. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll now move to agenda item number 3, which is a resolution, state revolving fund loan application for engineering design services for the expansion of wastewater treatment plant 2.
Thank you, Honorable Mayor, City Council. This is a continuation of a conversation we've been having for a while for the long-term expansion. It's approximately, you know, 3 to 3.5 year time loan from the time we contemplated the expansion of capacity at the wastewater treatment plant through getting through the initial loan application, which is available in the clerk's office. Did not include it in the packet because it was over 1,100 pages, but Virginia didn't want me to point out that is available for anyone who wants to see it. But we're here today to talk with Steve Flanagan and the consultants from CPH on the timing and the process and requirements to move forward to authorize the application for approximately $1.4 million for design. Mr. Flanagan?
Thank you, Mr. Morton. Good morning, Mayor, City Council. We are here today to present to City Council an agenda item for consideration, which is tied to the growth of our beautiful city. This item is consistent with City Council Goal 1.2, assess the need to expand infrastructure for sustainable growth. The city has been growing with new building and development at a year-over-year increase now for several years. This is great for our local economy, but does require the city to work to keep our infrastructure capable of handling that additional demand. As a part of the many steps in the process of adding wastewater treatment plant capacity, we are here today to request approval from council to complete the application for the Florida Department of Environmental Protection State Revolving Fund Design Loan for expansion of wastewater treatment plant number 2. We have with us today to present to you Mr. David Gearock, President of CPH Engineers, and Mr. Jeff Wilson, Manager of Raftulis Rate Consultants. And with that, I will turn it over to Mr. Gearock at this time. It's all yours, David. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Steve.
Can you hear me? Some technical difficulties.
He has something on in his office. Yeah, could be like a speaker.
Lucita, you sounded fine there. Not sure what you did.
Steve, can you hear us now?
Yes, you're clear now, David.
Okay. I apologize for that. Our new times. As Steve stated, this item is for approving of the funding for the design of wastewater treatment facility number 2 expansion. Previously, the city has submitted a request for inclusion to the state to be listed on the SRF program for funding. The council has approved the capital finance plan and the facilities plan associated with this project in December. Or it's completed in December and approved in January. The city has previously approved the design contract for the wastewater treatment facility, and that work is moving forward. In February, the funding was approved by SRF, and the intent of the current process is to approve the loan application and approve the city manager to execute the loan application and to also execute the loan agreement and negotiate the terms of the loan agreement. Following the completion of design, which is scheduled to be completed towards the end of this year in December, we would apply for funding for the construction portion of this project at the SRF hearing, which normally occurs in February. So the intent would be to obtain construction funding in February, then be able to proceed with construction starting towards the summer of 2021, with completion of the project toward the end of the year 2022 to meet the schedule that has been submitted to FDEP and is approved by the city. Could go to the next slide, please. The overall construction cost for the project is approximately $20 million. The resolution today, again, is only for the design portion related to this project and to approve the state revolving loan application and the resolution to allow the city manager to execute the application. Sorry. The overall proposed expansion would be to increase the capacity by 2 million gallons per day. Current capacity of the wastewater treatment facility is 2 million gallons per day. So upon completion, the revised capacity of the facility would be approximately 4 million gallons per day. The estimated design cost for the project is $1.4 million, and this has previously been approved by the City Council, and that work is underway. This is basically a reimbursement type of a loan, so the city pays for the cost up front. Upon completion of design, then the city would apply to the state to get reimbursed for the costs that they have incurred. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Jeff. He can talk about the repayment for the loan.
Jeff, are you with us?
I don't see him on, Steve, unless he called in.
I saw him on earlier. I guess maybe he got kicked off somehow.
He's still there.
Can you hear me?
There you go.
Yes.
Okay, I was muted and I could not get off of mute for some reason, so sorry about that. All right, take over where David left off. He pretty much covered most of it, but we did a financial forecast as part of the capital finance plan associated with that $1.4 million loan, and the annual payments assumed, they're assumed to begin in fiscal year 2022. And the good thing about the SRF loans is you don't begin payment until those are the design is complete. So the estimated annual payments for this loan are approximately $72,000 per year. And then it assumes an extremely low interest rate of 0.117%, which is an incredible rate for long-term borrowing purposes. And also, the SRF loan requirements require you to have a debt service coverage with this loan of 1.15 times net operating revenues. The issuance of the 2021 SRF design loan cost is an effective way for the city to finance this project. The issuance costs for SRF versus conventional borrowing are significantly lower, and as I mentioned earlier, an extremely low interest rate. If you were looking at doing utility revenue bonds or other types of loans, you could be looking at a rate of approximately 3.5% to 4% for those types of loans. So an interest rate of below 1% is an incredible rate. And again, it talked about you have the ability to defer the payment until the project is complete. And then in conclusion, since we did a rate study recently for the city, we already implemented rate increases in anticipation of construction of this wastewater treatment plant expansion. So the existing rates already approved by the city, along with the rate indexing adjustments in the future, are projected to be adequate to meet the financial plan. So we're not requesting the adoption of any additional rate adjustments. The city has the financial capability to repay the 2021 SRF design loan and maintain the overall credit worthiness of the system. With that, that's our conclusions. We'll open it up to any questions you may have.
Council, any questions or comments on this agenda item?
Not at this point.
I see none. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Council.
Thank you.
Conclude all their presentations?
Yes, for that item, yes.
Okay. Agenda item number 4 is a resolution, approval of the E-section canal improvements.
Thank you, Honorable Mayor, City Council. We have three items that are more or less related together, and we have Carl Cote, Director of Engineering, and Mike Peel here to present.
Would you like me to read all of them, and then you can just present as one?
Carl, are you comfortable presenting as one unit, or do we need to separate these out? That I'm unsure of, if we're going to mess up the...
That can be all presented as one item.
Thank you, Mayor.
All right, so I'm going to go ahead and read agenda item number 5 and 6, a resolution authorizing the city's finance director to certify and execute the proposed capital financing plan for the E-section canal improvements. And agenda item number 6 is resolution approving a license agreement with the Flagler County for the construction phase of the E-section canal drainage improvements. Okay.
Yeah, well, I would just actually, with that, thank you very much, Mayor. I would turn it over to Carl Cote to begin.
Thank you.
Okay. Good morning, Mayor and Council. We're here today to talk about our stormwater program. I'm actually going to have Michael Peel, our stormwater engineer that is overseeing that program, make a presentation and go through that. We have our consultant, John Mitten from DRP, that assisted with putting together our SRF loan application for this project here as well.
Good morning, Mayor and Council. We have 3 resolutions in front of you this morning, all related to the E-section canal improvements. The first one is requesting approval of E-section drainage plans to comply with the SRF loan requirements. The second is asking for authorization for our finance director to execute the capital financing plan. And the third is approval of a license agreement with Flagler County to allow us temporary construction access across state-owned lands. The E-section canals, East Hampton and Eisenhower waterways, are the primary outfalls for the E-section neighborhood. The canals drain from south to north into the Royal Palms Canal. From this point, they drain east through Graham Swamp and Beulah Creek and ultimately to the Intracoastal Waterway. This project will restore the entire length of both canals to their original cross sections, which will increase the depth and the width of the canals. This will improve the conveyance capacity of the canals and the ability to drain a little more quickly during major storm events. also because we are increasing the normal permanent volume of water that's typically held in the canals, and removing sediment, potential contaminants will greatly increase water quality in the area. It will also improve the level of service for the neighborhood swells and ditch system. The canals currently are within a city-owned right-of-way within the East Section neighborhood. However, when you get to the north end, where we start crossing the FPL easement between there and the Royal Palms right-of-way, is state-owned lands. The city does not currently have any easement through there, so the purpose of the license agreement with Flagler County, who's the administrator for the property, is to give us access during construction. You'll also notice there's some phase lines on the graphic. This is because of how the construction plans were set up to give us flexibility for awarding the project in phases, depending on funding availability. However, this SRF loan is for the entire project, both phases one and two.
So what the phases then, so you said depending on funding availability, the scope of the project will be identified as in entirety. Are you phasing it out for other reasons?
That was an initial thought when we were developing the construction plans, because we were not sure what the funding was going to be. So we set it up in a way that would allow us flexibility toward phase one and two, or just phase one if we couldn't move forward with both. But the loan request is for the entire length of the canals, both phases.
Okay.
The loan doesn't cover 100% of the cost. It covers the majority. It will pay for all work associated with the dredging of the canals, clearing and grubbing, erosion control management, revegetating. Approximate cost is, with contingencies, approximately $1.9 million. There's a small portion that isn't included in the loan. It's associated more with roadway culverts, desilting pipes. It's approximately $347,000. And there is the possibility of performing that portion of the work in-house if necessary. The total estimated construction cost is approximately $2.3 million, and that includes a 2% loan fee. These are some of the major milestones associated with the application process. We completed the request for inclusion in October. The construction plans are 100% complete. We are now at items 3, 4, 5, and 6, basically preparing the readiness to proceed package. If council approves resolutions before you this morning, then this package will be submitted to DEP by June 30th. Once we receive an executed license agreement with Flagler County, we will receive a water management district permit. The FDEP public meeting will be on August 12th. We anticipate bidding and construction award in November and construction completion around May of 2021. This is a graphic illustrating the loan flow process. It actually comes from the DEP website. As I mentioned, we've completed the request for inclusion. The planning documents are complete. All of the agency reviews are complete. DEP has completed the finding of no significant impact. And we are ready to submit our readiness to proceed package. The DEP determines the interest rate based on a quarterly bond buyer index. And currently that index is 2.49%. When you plug it into their formula, that essentially equates to a 0% interest rate. Based on what they have been telling us this past week, that's been pretty steady. It's, you know, it's always subject to change, but do not anticipate any change in the near future. And this is just a graphical representation of the historical rates since 1970. And you can see that it's currently at an all-time low. And as I mentioned, that could change, but it's not expected to change. And be happy to respond to any questions or comments.
What's the timeline for the actual project itself, and how does this fit into our master plan of our stormwater plan, and how will this benefit the swale system over in the neighborhoods adjoining this?
The timeline is have bid award by the end of this year and construction completion by midsummer. This is fits into our master plan and our plan to dredge and increase the capacity and conveyance of the canal system. One of the reasons we focused on this area, and we actually started focusing on it quite some time ago, several years ago, is because of some of the drainage issues in the neighborhood, and it drains into probably our largest canal, Royal Palms Canal. And hopefully, and it will improve the effect it will have on the swale and ditch system is to increase the capacity to convey the water out. The canals will be wider. You'll have a larger cross-sectional area above the normal water, which will increase the ability to move water out. It'll remove some obstructions where we have ditches that drain into the canal that have silted up, essentially blocked. So as we continue to clean out the ditches and rehabilitate the swales in the neighborhood, you should see more benefit from that.
So is this utilizing the LIDAR technology for the area to understand the topography and how it drains?
We initially used the LIDAR when we started developing the concepts and looking at and developing the drainage calculations for determining the amount of dredging that would be required within the canals. We actually did a ground survey, our consultant performed a survey to kind of truth the right to LIDAR and to get a more accurate estimate of how much sediment would need to be removed.
So the reason why I ask that is, you know, Matt, this is a perfect example of a great launch on a communication strategy. What we could do is taking all of the utility billing contact information email list that we have, we could geofence the neighborhood in which it's impacting, benefiting, frankly, and I think we can just directly communicate sort of the timeline, the approach, the outcome, you know, just everything of benefit to our residents to inform them directly, and then obviously we want to inform the community as a whole, but really as we do these sections in this master plan, I think it's a great way of offering that to our residents.
Absolutely.
And this, we'll be posting information on our website to inform the neighborhood. We also plan to have a public meeting and gather some neighborhood input.
So yes, as you mentioned, Mayor, Council, we've been working with communications and Tyler's developing those strategies. One, this is a citywide interest because we're improving the overall stormwater conveyance and stormwater system, but to your point also, how we specifically target residents also directly impacted, and so I know we are working on that strategy. So thank you.
I've been at some of those meetings, especially that involved the golf course, and very good. They're doing a very, very good job. So I hope this project goes ahead, and I'm directly affected by it, so I'm going to be a recipient of this good news. Thank you.
Any other questions, Council, on this agenda item? And I know we have, do we have other presentations with it?
With this, I believe that was the presentation.
Okay, perfect.
Yeah, that was it.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it. Keep up the good work. This is a very exciting project. And as we continue to make these improvements, our residents will continue to benefit. So thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mayor.
Okay. We'll now move to agenda item number 7, which is a presentation overview of property taxes and trim process.
Thank you, Honorable City Council. We do have Helena Alves here today to discuss the 2021 fiscal year trim process and where we're at as it relates to the budget.
Good morning, Mayor, City Council. We're here, just like Mr. Morton stated, to talk to you about property taxes and trim in preparation for our general fund budget workshop that is tentatively scheduled for July 14th. I will let Gwen, our budget and procurement manager, go over the timeline and the trim process. Thank you.
Good morning, Mayor and City Council. As Helena said, we're here today to go through the trim. So first we're gonna go through the budget presentation, the timeline. So we came to you in March with the survey results and then the annual City Council staff evaluation. Then in April, we did the financial audit, the year-to-date budget presentation in May, along with the fund accounting presentation, the 10-year CIP plan and revenue restrictions. And then today, we're here to talk to you about the property tax presentation. The next part of the timeline is July through September. In July, on the 14th, we'll come to you with the general fund workshop. We will also be adopting the maximum millage rate budget workshops along with the public hearings to adopt the final millage rates in September. And then, of course, in October, because our timeline doesn't end, we will have the fiscal year 20 closeout and year-end department reviews. So now to talk about the truth and millage, or formerly known as TRIM. This is a process for all taxing authorities to follow. So we submit a package to TRIM for evaluation to make sure that we meet the requirements. We also receive a letter of certification, and this is also something that everyone has to follow the same rules, and it gives the goal of having a full disclosure to all of our taxpayers. In June, on the 1st, we received the preliminary tax assessment from the property appraiser's office. It came in at a projection of $5.7 billion. This was an increase of 5.8%. On July 1st, we will get the final certification, and we will use that number when we come to you on July 14th to bring you the general fund budget. And this will be the opportunity to set the maximum millage rate. As a reminder, the assessed millage can be reduced, but it cannot be increased after this point. We will also come to you July 21st to adopt the proposed millage rate, and the 35-day certification period will happen by August 4th.
Yes, now we'll talk about how our property taxes calculated. So the property appraiser determines the value of the property. Then there are certain exemptions that are applied by statute, like homestead, senior, widower, disabled, blind, military. There's a series of exemptions that are applied to it. And then the net amount is our taxable value. The trim part is the only portion that City Council controls, is the percentage that they apply to the taxable value. Now, there's a difference between the market value and the taxable value, and because of the Save Our Homes Act, our property assessments are very unique here in Florida. So you can have two properties that have the same market value, but depending on how long they've been homesteaded, they have a completely different taxable value. So this example,
Helena, you call it unique. It's actually, you know, it's not a fair application. Frankly, I think we just need to be very open about that. That's not our application. That is a state application. But there's an inequity in that, and so it's a good point to bring that up to our residents that have moved here that are new to the community and speak to their neighbors about taxes. I get this question often. I don't know if other council members do, is why are my taxes higher than, you know, Joe who lives down the street? And frankly, a lot of it has to do with Save Our Homes. So unique is a good point, but I think it's more of an inequity.
I understand. That's kind of what we're trying to depict here with this graph. Is the property, you know, in year one, they both have the same taxable value, but because of the Save Our Homes, in year four, if they have been sold and there's new owners, then their value can be much higher, and they'll be paying much higher taxes for the same community and same services. Yeah. This is an example of a property with a taxable value of approximately $100,000. That's still the baseline that we use as far as taxable value here in the city of Palm Coast. And the importance to notice here is that the city portion only represents 23% of the total property taxes. Now, the trim notice is sent out by the property appraiser's office, and it will list where the public hearings will be held. This is last year's, and you can see we set the city FUMCO set the maximum proposed rate at 4.6989, and that resulted in this particular property with a $430 for the city of FUMCO out of the 2022 property tax bill.
And the other, it should be noted, the other institutions that are listed on the trim notice, we have no governance over as far as setting their millage rate, applying any taxes, spending any of the dollars. You know, the school district really goes to sort of the state Department of Ed, but these others, we really have to be, I think, very clear, again, is 23% of your tax bill the city of Palm Coast controls. And is under our jurisdiction. It's why we have all these conversations that we do have. However, the other rates that are set are completely out of our control.
Yes, in this next slide, we have an example of the breakdown per dollar of tax paid by resident. As you can see there, the Flagler County receives the largest majority at 41 cents. Or the school board at 31 cents, and then the city of Palm Coast 23 cents, with 4 cents being split between the St. John's Water Management District, the Flagler Mosquito Control Fund, and some of the voted debt.
That's a great depiction.
On our next slide here, we're gonna look at how are our ad valorem taxes used. So that 23 cents per dollar, how do we use it? And you can see more than 50% of it really goes to public safety, with 38% funding our fire department and 15% for police protection in our contract with the sheriff's office. The other large part of this goes to streets and parks maintenance. The portion here outlined for capital projects is actually the amount that is transferred to the stormwater project. Currently, there are 16 Florida cities that fall within that 70 to 100,000 of population. Of these cities, Palm Coast has the fifth lowest millage rate. Of course, this is not apples to apples comparison because we don't have details about these communities, the services offered, For example, as we discussed in one of our earlier slides, our streets and park maintenance is supported by ad valorem, and our road miles may significantly differ from road miles in other communities, so the level of service and community expectations. So it just puts us, you know, in the fifth, but what, like I said, it's not apples to apples. Next, we're going to take a look at our millage rate and property tax history. As you can see, it has been increasing, as well as our population. Now, for the current year, like Gwen mentioned earlier, we did receive the preliminary estimate from the property appraiser's office. It amounts to about a 5.83% increase. This morning, I received the new construction portion of that increase, and it's about $160 million. So it's about half and half between current properties and the portion that's attributable to new construction. Of course, we will wait until our July 1st final valuation to finalize our general fund budget and to present to council. But as you can see, it has been increasing. We want to remind the public of where they can find all of our budget information. Transparency is very important to us. As in previous years, we have set up the fiscal year 2021 budget preparation link on the city's website. This is where we'll post all of our presentations, our budget timeline, and any supporting documentations and worksheets to the level of detail on the department's budgets. You'll be able to see what's allocated to salaries versus benefits versus operating expenditures. Those will be posted before our presentation to council. And at the same time, we'll work with the communications team to make sure we're keeping the public updated on where to find all this great information. And as a result, as a reminder, we'll be back July 14th to go over the general fund budget in detail. That concludes my comments. I'll take any questions.
Council, any questions or comments at this time?
Not at this time.
Thank you.
Great presentation, Helena. Thanks for keeping us always in check, and really appreciate your conservative approach. We spend these dollars wisely. We have for years, and it's nice to see we're able to provide the level of service to our residents in doing so. So thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll now move to agenda item number 8, which is under written items, a resolution approving a master price agreement with Pentair Filtration Solutions for the purchase of ultra filtration modules.
Thank you, Honorable Mayor.
Exciting. Yeah.
I was actually thinking that when you said it. Thank you, Honorable Mayor, City Council. I would have Pete Roussel here this morning to introduce the item.
Yes, good morning, Mayor and Council. This is a normal routine practice to replace the membrane modules at plant number 2 on the zero liquid discharge. They're about 5 years old, and life expectancy is roughly 5, sometimes 7 years, depending on a few things. But we would like to replace these as a result of low permeability production out of the units. And again, this is on the ZLT, zero liquid discharge side of plant number 2.
Council, any questions or comments on this agenda item?
No, not at this time.
Seeing none, we appreciate you being here and presenting today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Agenda item number 9 is a resolution approving a master services agreement with Parkson Corporation for the purchase and installation of a dewatering screw press. And so exciting.
What is that?
I don't know.
Well, since you asked, Mr. Runkeen, Councilman Runkeen, the Honorable Mayor and Council, we have Danny Ashburn here to tell you exactly what this is and why we are proposing to bring it forward.
Morning, Mayor, Council. This unit is tied to our mechanical bar screens at Wastewater Treatment Plant Number 1. In 2019, you approved the replacement of the 2 mechanical bar screens, which basically remove undesirable debris and plastics from entering to the treatment plant and disposes of them. This unit here is over 15 years old, and we looked into rehabbing it, and the cost for rehab was really not cost efficient over the half, over 50% of the cost of a new one. This unit right here collects the debris from the bar screens and acts as sort, you know, if you would, a trash compactor. What it does is it dewaters the screenings and compresses them before it goes into the dumpster to be disposed of. This unit is a Parkson unit, so it fits into the two Parkson bar screens. So as far as service and repair, we only have to deal with one manufacturer. So this was the best choice for staff to choose. There was one other company that supplied a bid, but they were unresponsive. They didn't allow for the installation, and their references was basically in Europe. They didn't have any installations in the United States, so we chose to disqualify them.
Council, any questions or comments on this agenda item?
Oh, that's it. Now I know what it is. The Watering Screw Press. Very good. Thank you. Very clear.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Agenda item number 10 is a resolution approving a contract with AWA Contracting for the K6 weir at Smith Trail.
Last item, thank you again, Honorable Mayor, City Council. We have Mike Peel back with us to discuss this item, introduce this item.
Good morning again. This is for the replacement of K6 weir, which is one of our older weirs. It has a lot of issues. It's deteriorated quite a bit, and it's also for replacement of the pipes under Smith Trail immediately downstream from the weir. This is was one of our capital improvement projects that was part of this year's budget.
And we were not able to secure any water management district grants?
Unfortunately, we weren't. We applied several times. We met with the district. The biggest issue is we did a lot of modeling for this project to try to increase our chances. But essentially, we could not demonstrate that there was any flood mitigation benefit to replacing the weir. The Water Management District basically viewed it as a maintenance project, and we did not score very well.
So I wonder if there's a different strategy that would apply as far as not just ongoing or maintenance or upgrades to the aging infrastructure. But I know during times of emergencies, when we are activated in the EOC, we're able to control the modern weirs remotely to lower the water table in an emergency situation. Has that ever been looked at as far as maybe infrastructure for even perhaps DEM grants, maybe from an emergency scenario that would apply towards safety during these events, primarily hurricanes?
I think sometimes that would apply, and going forward on the ones that we're doing in the future, I feel pretty confident that we'll be in a strong position for grants. The issue with this particular weir is it seems that weir was primarily to maintain a minimum water elevation in the canal, and even if you lower the water completely, it had no significant impact on the resulting flood elevations downstream. One of the things we did do to reduce the cost, because it doesn't installing controls and gates did not provide any significant flood protection benefit. We eliminated that, which greatly reduced the cost. So it's designed to maintain a minimum elevation, and then it provides overflow, but
okay.
This one will not have controls on it.
Okay, and it comes out of which budget?
This particular, I just closed the agenda item, is coming, I believe, out of utility capital.
Okay. All right. Any questions or comments, Council? Seeing none, thank you for your presentation. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll now open it up to the second portion of public participation. This is for members of the public that were not able to speak at the beginning of our meeting. We're asking all the members of the public to please state your name for the record after calling in and unmuting with star 9. The number is 386-223-1690. You will have up to 3 minutes. Please state your name for the record. Seeing none, we will close public participation. Discussion by City Council of matters not on the agenda. Councilmember Brancuno.
Right. Other than thanking everyone and the staff, without exception, for the job they're doing on this hard times, I'd appreciate it. And also, Vice Mayor Nick Kloufas, yes, you could call me Eddie. You could call me Eddie, okay?
Vice Mayor Kloufas.
Excellent. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Sorry for my candor earlier, but thank you for the forgiveness. I don't have too much to add to today's meeting. The one thing that I have been, I actually ran into a few neighbors of mine, and I'm sure that they're all talking amongst themselves, but they had asked me about the viability of some water detection systems that they provided me articles to that I would certainly provide to Steve about COVID detection in the wastewater and how they're using those type of data points to be able to project just like infection rates. And I was just curious if we could just get some of that information, like the cost of those type of things, or like what's even a valid solution. I am not an expert in either of those fields. So I more or less told the individuals that I would ask for some more information on viability, but I don't ask that multiple hours are spent. If someone could provide myself and perhaps at the council, if they're interested, with a little bit of background on what's actually achievable for a realistic price, I would greatly appreciate it, just so I have more information to give feedback to the individuals who engaged me. Besides that, I just thank everyone for the strategic action planning and the initiatives that our council have set forward, and I'm thankful to serve with so many people who are on the forefront of, moving our city forward, and I'm very thankful that we basically all align with the same goals of moving the city forward, so thank you guys.
Thank you, and I can add some value to your points. Dr. Stephen Bickle, our medical director at our health department, many of you may know. He is just a wealth of knowledge and information. In particular, he has been on the forefront of our response to COVID-19 and how we've managed this global pandemic here locally, and has been a great advisor regularly to us. And so he reached out after our virtual town hall meetings. We have weekly conversations just to get a little bit of the landscape of what other communities around the world are doing to mitigate some of the impact of COVID. And at the same time he introduced this exact testing of stormwater, I had sent something to our city manager, Matt Morton, on articles that I was reading about it. And then subsequent to that, Matt and the health department have been on a few calls, including our utility department, to move forward with an assessment and a proposal to start actually looking at testing of our stormwater for COVID. So you can definitely respond to, I know Dr. Davidson called me as well, I was going to respond to him later today, but Vice Mayor Kloufas, feel free to share that information. There is more to come with that this council will have to review as far as the proposal goes and what kind of data sets would be important for us to understand moving forward and to capture in an effort to make better decisions as we continue to go through this response.
Awesome. Thank you. And I guess I rest my case on serving with individuals who are thinking forward, so I appreciate that, and I will certainly recon the information to the individuals who are interested, so thank you.
Thank you. Thank you as well. Council Member Cuff.
I have nothing for this meeting, Mayor.
Thank you so much. It's nice to see that everyone on the call finally got haircuts as well. I know. Oh,
sorry. Eventually.
I know. Well, I appreciate it.
Personal attack.
And I have nothing for this meeting. Discussion by city attorney of matters not on the agenda. No?
Just shake your head. We can't hear you.
Okay. Discussion by city manager items not on the agenda.
So my understanding, and I hope I'm not out of line, but we have virtual town hall tomorrow. It's not too late to register and submit your questions. As promised, we'll have a lot of good information on phase two and what that means specifically for the city of Palm Coast and what it means for return to physical meetings of the city council, which our first one will be July 7th. And we're making plans for that. Again, as we mentioned last week, and we'll talk again tomorrow as staff, we will be requiring masks, we'll be taking temperatures, and there will be a check-in station to answer no to the health criteria, but we will be returning. So again, not too late, please submit your questions, and I'm looking forward, as always, to the town hall. Those continue to be, as everyone knows, extraordinarily well engaging with the residents. I'd be remiss not to mention we are officially, I guess, week one live with Field Service Lightning for both maintenance and for public works, and it's amazing already to see the level of engagement to start to capture, similarly to what we did with our several months of experience with utilities, where we're learning that we can make better decisions on how to deploy our crews to deliver higher levels of service without increasing our costs. We're interested to see what kind of data we get, and it's already coming in. It's phenomenal. Great to see it and to start to be able to put our hands around it and to understand what we want to do. And again, I thank Council for that investment. And I bring that up because it is the continued investment. We did both these projects in-house with staff we have, licenses we already own, and no additional cost to the city. So very proud of that moment. And we will continue to work to bring back, again, to your point earlier, Mayor, about how do we identify level of service? How does Council, how do we as staff do our job to inform you where we're at, what we believe, and let you make the guidance decisions. And this is one of those absolutely critical tools in my mind that is giving us information that we can bring those stories back to you, bring that real information, and say, this is where we're at as a city, and this is how we're going to meet and help you identify targets. So been going very well, and I'm just really excited to see at the end of the month where our first 30 days is and how staff is embracing it wonderfully. Very excited. In fact, I will mention you find unlikely leaders sometimes. I appreciate Matt Mansell and Brad Clark and Marvin Calderon in Public Works, an internal champion who saw the value of getting away from multiple paper copies and emails and lost sticky notes to moving to a system that he can manage at the click of a button and see what his staff is doing on the dashboard. So just great opportunity. And again, thank you to the whole council for your continued support of this initiative.
And I just want to add, I thank you for your updates that you provide to the council especially I appreciate the photos of the teams over at Public Works that were learning how to utilize the new system, both with Steve Harris, who's on with us as well, but Matt Mansell driving his team, frankly, forward in a way that it will be transformative in that entire department.
Can I say, and I'm sorry to gloss back on, I know my time is up, but that was truly exciting. And what I mean by that is typically we have a software, we want to do an upgrade, we have to contact a company, sometimes they'll send a consultant out, they'll fly somebody out, or we're on a conference call, and it was amazing to watch Mr. Harris and our customer service employee, Jamie, work in a room with our staff, training our staff to design a system the way we need it, all accomplished in-house, and to see that energy and excitement, and frankly, that we have that capability now is great. So again, thank you, Council.
Super.
Yes. Thank you so much. Okay.
I'll make a motion to adjourn this.
Oh, yes, here we are. Thank you.